Okay. Good morning, everybody. Before we proceed, just please be seated, and then we'll proceed a little bit different today than we normally do. Justice Sadie, as you can see on the video conference, is participating from Carson City. Justice Douglas is also participating in the case. He will participate in the decision. Unfortunately, he can't be able to argue because he has to go deliver a panel presentation in Reno to a ethics panel. So he committed to that some time ago, and unfortunately had to leave this morning for the airport. So anyway, but he will participate. So it's one justice really can't do anything on the Supreme Court. So we'll help with Justice Sade and Justice Douglas. So Justice, we'll have some questions as we proceed forward. Is counsel for the state here? Oh, please come on up, then.
Okay.
Okay, very well. Well, let me call the case if you're ready to go, and we will proceed. Okay, this is case number 58904, Rogelio Martinez. How does he pronounce his name, Ms. Stevenson?
Martinez-Oriano.
Okay, thank you. Very well. This is the state of Nevada. And so we'll proceed with the argument. Ms. Stevenson, you may proceed on behalf of the appellants.
Before I begin, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Well, please support. My name is Sharon Dickinson, and I represent Rogelio Martinez-Oriano. In the case of Glover versus the 8th Judicial District Court, this court upheld a trial court's decision to grant a mistrial when in closing arguments. A defense attorney commented on evidence admitted at trial. Specifically in the Glover case, he commented on the defendant's statements that were not admitted into evidence. What's significant about that case, when compared to this case, is that it stands for the proposition that an attorney cannot violate a court's orders to prohibit certain arguments in closing. In this case, that's exactly what occurred. Prior to the closing arguments, the defense attorney made a motion. He was concerned that the prosecutor was going to comment on the defendant's right to testify. He was concerned that she was going to argue burden shifting. He made a list of all his concerns, and the court granted his motion. So under Glover, she's prohibited from going into these without the court possibly granting a mistrial. In this case, in the rebuttal closing argument, the prosecutor completely ignored the court's orders. She began by qualifying reasonable doubt. She stated, it's not mere possible doubt, it has to be actual doubt. The defense attorney objected and the court agreed, sustained the objection, and asked her to move on. Told the jury to look at the jury instructions. Did that stop? No, that didn't stop the problems. Then she commented on the defendant's right to testify and commented on the defendant's burden of proof. Specifically, she said, he doesn't have to take the stand. However, I submit to you in this case, he had to take the stand. How else do you prove or disprove? The defense attorney again objected. Clearly,
what did the court do after the objection to that?
The court merely asked the prosecutor to move on. At this point, however, the defense attorney said, I'm asking for a mistrial, because now we've had 3 violations. The court denied the request for a mistrial. Did that stop the problems? No. Then she suggested the defendant was not telling the truth when he testified. The defense again objected. The court sustained the objection. But there wasn't any type of a curative instruction given. Did it stop them? No. This is all in the rebuttal closing. She then argued victims have rights and compared testifying to a tooth extraction. Again, the defense objected and the court overruled the objection. Now, the state, in their answering brief, admits that these errors occurred. However, they do not find them to be harmful. However, I would submit to you that under the Glover decision, If it's harmful for the defense attorney to violate a court's order, it's harmful for the prosecutor. In fact, the prosecutor should be held to a much higher standard because the defense attorney is there arguing for his client's life. The prosecutor is the government. They need to abide by all of the rules and the orders that the court gives. Now, that isn't the only reason for this court to reverse Mr. Rogelio Martinez Arellano's conviction. There were numerous problems after the jury went to deliberate. To begin with, one of the jurors admitted that he knew the victim in passing. The foreman sent a note to the court. The court removed that particular juror out of the jury room, put this juror in a separate room, had the attorneys come over to question him. While the juror was in the other room, it appears that the 11 other jurors continued to deliberate. We know that because there's another note that comes out where the jurors are asking to see Mr. Lee, the alleged victim in this case, his voluntary statement.
Well, how much time is the 12th juror out of the room? Do you know?
Well, we know that it was at least 15 minutes from the transcript. However, I think it would probably be a little bit longer than that because she had to get the defense attorney, the prosecutor, there to question this juror, and there was an evidentiary hearing. Basically, the court asked one question and let the parties question this juror. The state asked that he be removed. The defense objected. The defense argued that he had not shown a bias. He had not shown that there was anything that he had known from knowing Mr. Lee maybe 2 years ago. He didn't know him as a friend. He just knew him from going into that store. There was nothing that showed that he could not deliberate and be fair and unbiased. And more importantly, he was one of the only Hispanic, one of the only minorities on the 12th jury panel. The court, however, removed him. And the error was harmful because, as we stated in the Anderson case, a defendant has a constitutional right to have the jury that he helped select render the verdict. And that's not what happened in this case. But the problem is the errors didn't stop there. When the court went to replace an alternate, at first nobody was sure who the alternate was because of the mysterious selection of the alternate during jury selection, which I'll get to later. When the court replaced this juror and put an alternate in, she did not bring the jury back in the courtroom as she's required. Instead, she had her JEA just take the jury back and time to keep deliberating. So the problems we have, we have a jury that is deliberating, then we bring somebody new in, and the court never admonished the jurors that they needed to start anew, which is required under the statute. The other problem that occurred during deliberations was the readback. The jury had sent a note sometime while they were deciding to put the alternate back in that they wanted to see Mr. Lee's testimony of the voluntary statement because there was an issue as to whether or not he could identify Rogelio as, in fact, the person who allegedly had committed the crime. And when they were not allowed to have that, they asked for a readback. And that would have been Detective Garris's testimony. They brought the jury back in, and the court reporter selected some of the testimony, because it was all about, the testimony that they wanted to hear was about the notes that another detective had taken, Detective Stout, and the notes referred to Mr. Lee's initial identification of Rogelio. When the court did the readback, she didn't do a readback, she did video or audio playback. And I know the trial attorneys didn't object to that. I raised that on appeal as plain error. Because the problem with the video or audio is that you're reliving the testimony. You're saying the witness testified live for a second time. It unduly emphasizes that testimony. That testimony was in contention.
How should it have been done, in your opinion, the readback?
The readback, I think they should have done it orally, just to the audio. That would allow them to eliminate any objections or any improper evidence, because the defense had been objecting to this particular testimony from the beginning when it first started. So we had an objection with regard to Detective Garris's testimony when he testified, which involved a violation of discovery and hearsay confrontation, which was all overruled. And then we were showing it again in a video audio playback. So the jury was able to see this evidence twice that we initially objected to even begin with. If they're doing the playback, I say audio as opposed to the video, because I don't think it has as much of a visual impact. Also, under the Ninth Circuit rules, once a video audio or a playback of any type or readback is shown, there needs to be an admonishment. And there's no admonishment here, so the jury was never admonished to go ahead.
But the defense attorney didn't ask for the admonishment?
No, they did not. But the trial court should have given that admonishment anyway. I want to talk briefly about the problem with Detective Gere's testimony. We filed a pretrial motion asking for all the statements recorded or not recorded of Lee and all the other witnesses. The state said they gave us everything in the middle of his testimony in the trial. All of a sudden, notes came up from a Detective Stout. Mm-hmm. We objected it was hearsay. The state used it to try to firm up their identification. They needed to firm up the identification in part because Mr. Lee had difficulty with the English language. Mm-hmm. In fact, his testimony is filled with blanks where the court reporter couldn't even interpret what he was saying. So they were trying to bolster his testimony. That was an issue, too, where they objected and said he should have had a Korean interpreter. Issue number three.
Which statement do you take issue with that was hearsay?
Detective Pearson's? All of his was, mainly because he testified the notes from Detective Stout, and the notes from Detective Stout were Lee's statements. I know that I only have 4 minutes left. I can go briefly into the problem with the alternate and the jury.
Well, let me ask you the alternate to get to it. I know we've gone through this before, but my understanding was there was no objection from the defense or the state to this lottery selection of the alternate. Then
we don't know how the alternate was selected. In the case yesterday, it was a lottery.
They said the non-identification of the alternate under the statute.
Right. We have no idea how it was selected. There was no objection. There was a question as to who was going to be the alternate to replace them.
But what about that case we discussed previously, the Supreme Court decision on Justice Douglas's case as a district judge, where we said that there's no objection, it's harmless?
Well, in the Moore case, it was harmless because there was no objection and the alternate was never used. So this is distinguishable from Moore because here we use the alternate. We objected to using this particular alternate when the regular juror was removed. So this is different than Moore. So I think there is some prejudice.
Can I ask you one other question? And then Mr. Justice Say has any questions. If you need a little more time, we'll give it to you. On the booking photo, explain to me how that happened. You know, there was testimony about, is this your picture? And all of the I mean, was that photo admitted into evidence previously? Or,
I believe the photo was. I just included a snippet of the photo in my cumulative error because it's improper for the photos to be admitted. And I also believe I put a copy of it in the appendix. So I do believe that the photo was admitted.
Okay.
And if I'm incorrect, I'll correct the
record. We'll look at it, make sure we'll verify that. Okay, you have about 2.5 minutes, or 2 minutes. We'll give you an additional 2 minutes in rebuttal, so you have 4 minutes, and the state will have 17 minutes to equalize the time. Okay, counsel, if you want to proceed on behalf of the state.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Agnes Botello, and I'm here representing the state. Is there a particular issue you would like me to address first?
Well, why don't you address the issues Ms. Dickinson raised, and let's get the state's perspective on that, and then we'll see if Justice Sade and I have any additional questions.
Yes, Your Honor. With regard to my comments on the rebuttal, I'll preface it initially by saying that a majority of the comments were made in response to defense counsel's very inflammatory three-hour-long closing arguments. We noted in our brief that all but one of the statements that the appellant is challenging now was sustained. But I believe it was in the overabundance of caution. For instance, there was a section where I spoke about reasonable doubt, and reasonable doubt with regard to that was taken in total context. My comments were that, you know, it has to be mere, it can't be mere doubt, it can't be based on speculation or guess, it has to be actual doubt. And with regard to, I was really reading instruction number, whatever.
So you were just commenting on the jury instruction?
Yes, Your Honor. And I wanted to direct them to that particular jury instruction. With regard to the one comment that they have now raised, which is my comment about the victim having to testify, comparing it to a tooth extraction. Actually, in defense counsel's closing arguments, I believe it's page number 1091 in volume number 8, Mr. Emmerman, when he closed, said, "When I spoke to him, I told you during the murder, don't hold it against me, or if you do, no, I didn't. I said, if you hold it against me, don't take it out on my client, because cross-examining Mr. Lee was like a painful tooth extraction. It would have been great if it was like some, I don't know if any of you are old enough for the Perry Mason show." And he goes on, he said, "I wish I was good enough or it worked this way where I could have gone instead and just had a nice polite conversation with Mr. Lee and everything I wanted would come out. And he was basically a liar and a criminal, right? I had to go ahead and work at it to present this to you." My comment with regard to in rebuttal was, defense counsel referred to it as a painful tooth extraction, but Mr. Lee was subjected to, I believe, almost 2 days, several hours long of direct and cross-examination, primarily cross-examination. Mm-hmm. And at some points, there were definitely sections where Judge Skeen had to admonish defense counsel with regard to the way he was phrasing his questions. And I think that bears on the other issue as to whether or not Mr. Lee needed a Korean interpreter. Mr. Lee is of Korean descent, but he had been in the United States for 20 plus years, was my understanding. Defense counsel and the investigators actually went out and spoke to Mr. Lee. In fact, their investigator testified at the trial about his conversations with Mr. Lee. Mr. Lee adequately answered all of the questions in English I asked him prior to that, whether he felt more comfortable with a Korean interpreter, and he indicated that he did not. And the court was very mindful of whether or not he could be understood, and Judge Scanlon noted that if at some point it became apparent that he was not able to participate in the proceedings or if he couldn't answer questions correctly, that she would request an interpreter be used. Mr. Lee had difficulty during cross-examination answering questions because, frankly, the cross-examination questions were very, very confusing. There's one that sticks out in my mind, particularly where defense counsel, knowing that he was speaking to a Korean, a man of Korean descent, kept telling Mr. Lee, "We're not talking about tea in China, Mr. Lee. We're talking about trial, or we're talking about this." And he used such words where it was easy to confuse him. And I believe, in all candor, that that was part of trial strategy. Later on, they called him a liar, they called him all kinds of stuff, and I believe it was strategy to try to get it in such a way where he appeared to be not so truthful in front of the jury.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
More concerned about the conduct of the prosecution that is alleged to have been improper, and that is with respect to the booking photo comments, if any, that were made about the defendant's obligation to testify. Could you please touch upon those?
Yes, Your Honor. I did make reference when I read through the transcripts. The defendant in this case took the stand, and he proffered an explanation as to how he had been at the store earlier that day, kind of around the time that the crime is alleged to have occurred, and he purchased cigarettes or something like that. I absolutely said he had no obligation to take the stand. I said, he doesn't have to take the stand. In this particular case, he did, because he had to explain this particular, how it was that his badge, because if you recall, his badge, his work badge, was found with the victim's blood on it in one of the soda machine boxes beneath the chip rack or something like that.
But is it proper to make the statement that the defendant had to take the stand for whatever reason? I understand the reasons for it, but that sort of gets kind of dicey here, Now, he didn't testify, and that's a fact, and I'm sure at the beginning of the trial, the judge instructed the jury veneer or whatever that a defendant has no obligation to testify, it's the defendant's choice, and don't hold it against the defendant. I think it's a typical instruction here, but I think Justice Sotomayor and I both were a little concerned about that, so if you can tell me why you think that was necessary and why that doesn't create burden shifting, because the defendant is presumed innocent, unless the jury convicts him. Justice Sotomayor?
In this case, if the defense theory is that he was there earlier to buy cigarettes and that we support and honor the presumption of innocence, he really doesn't have to do anything. He doesn't have to explain why his badge was there. And so the comment that comes thereafter about he had to explain how his badge got there, to me, is a problem.
I understand, Your Honors. I guess where it came out of was when the defendant did take the stand. And in this particular case, he did proffer a reason for having been in the store and why his badge could have been there. And I was simply commenting on, the next section, I talk about how whether or not his comments were reasonable, whether or not, they were credible, given the state of the other evidence of this case. And really, I was commenting on his testimony on the stand. Now, when I said something like he had to explain how his badge got there, or how his, they also brought in a defense investigator who talked about how he purchased cigarettes in that particular case, and the price of the cigarettes. They proffered a receipt from a purchase of a cigarette box months after the crime, perhaps before trial. And he needed to, set forth a reason for having been in the store. He said he purchased cigarettes. And in rebuttal, I presented Mr. Lee again with the receipts for that particular day. He uses a very old method of keeping the receipts that were printed. And I mentioned that, the price of the defendant's testimony, I almost impeached him that way, because he said he bought cigarettes, it was for the same exact price, it was at this exact time, and I found the register receipt showing no such purchase and showing that the price of the cigarettes was not even accurate at that time. So part of it was to comment on the reasonableness of what he said during trial. He was adamant that he purchased it for this particular price, and then on rebuttal, when I presented Mr. Lee with the receipts showing no such purchase, showing that the price of cigarettes wasn't right at that time, it was almost as an impeachment, a comment on what he had spoken about when he took the stand.
Okay. Just to say, I had a question too about the booking photo as well. Would you like to comment on why it was necessary to use that in the case?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It was mentioned in passing, so I'm not sure.
I guess I had a question. Was it admitted into evidence, and what were the facts and circumstances surrounding that? Why you chose to use that?
And I don't recall the specifics of, I'm sorry, I was briefed on all of the other issues. However, this was kind of mentioned in passing, and I'm not sure where it was mentioned at the very last court's brief indulgence.
Yeah, you have time. Just take a moment and take a look at that.
It is my understanding, counsel, if this is helpful at all, it is my understanding that when the defendant testified, he was asked to acknowledge or deny whether or not that was his picture. Does that help at all?
It doesn't, because I'm not sure if identity was obviously an issue in this case.
Our notes indicate, when preparing for this, that the state used the booking photo to show that the jury that although his hair was longer at trial at the time of the crime and arrest, he had an almost completely shaved head.
That does refresh my memory. It was due to identity. This case was an identity issue. Separate and apart from that, we have Mr. Lee, who is 100% positive that the defendant was the person who attacked him and tried to stab him during this robbery. We also had his badge found at the scene, which is what perpetuated his or what caused his arrest, but in any regard, it was to show how the defendant appeared at the time.
Now, it was just a photo, it had no numbers on it, or
it was
superimposed comments on his innocence or guilt or anything like that?
It was absolutely just the photo. I have never tried to admit a booking photo with any other kind of information on it.
Just to say, any more questions on the booking photo?
No, thank you, Justice Gibbons.
Okay. You may proceed,
With regard to the seating of the alternates, my understanding with how this occurred, and I read the transcripts for it this morning, is that after about an hour of deliberation, it came to our attention that one of the jurors had been to the store and had also had contact with the victim, Mr. Lee. Now, again, this is an identity case. Mr. Lee is a store owner. He has contact with lots of different people, and I can't say whether he knew this particular jury or not. But the fact of the matter is, he had owned that store for several years, and this juror, even though he was admonished when we were selecting a jury, that he should, if you recognize any of the names, any of the parties, come forward. He didn't feel it was appropriate to do so. And he did so only after they had began talking about it. Before he could share any kind of outside information with the other jurors, though, he disclosed the fact that he knew the victim and had been in the store 20 times, at least in the last 2 years. My recollection is that his girlfriend worked in the same shopping center in England, and he would go to see her. He would go into the store to buy a soda. Mr. Lee is essentially a single worker. He has a friend that helps him out every once in a while, but my understanding is he was usually the one working 6 to 7 days a week. Whenever the store was open, Mr. Lee was there. So this particular juror had been there 20 times in the last 2 years or 2 years prior. And he specifically remembered Mr. Lee and told the court when we had a hearing that he had contact with him. He said hi, he said bye. And honestly, I'm not sure if that information would have been good or bad or if he would have shared it. But the fact of the matter is, made this one to Judge Skin at the time. We wanted jurors who didn't have any outside information.
Now, Ms. Higgins said this juror was Hispanic. Is that your recollection?
Yes, that is my recollection. And with regard to that, I didn't challenge him. He was placed on the jury. The defense didn't move to strike him either, and I certainly didn't. I felt that he could be fair and impartial given the panel's.
But you did ask to remove him after this testimony came out about his visiting the store and all.
I did, and And when I read through the transcripts, I specifically said, I'm not sure which way this would lean, but in the overabundance of caution, I asked that we seat an alternate. We had two. My fear was that he had been to the store and he would share outside information, good or bad, with the other jury members. I think the potential for the taint, you know, or the presentation of outside evidence was not necessary, given the fact that we had two other jurors who did not have that experience with Mr. Lee or the store.
I think we understand that, but your reason. Can you tell us about the methodology the judge used for selecting alternates and any comments you have on that issue?
I don't recall how that came about. I don't know if it was an off the record, you know, this is how this court does it, or I just know that when she read off the two jury, the alternates, neither of us had an objection, which would lead me to believe that I at least knew.
Well, as you know now, there is a statute that gives the parties a right to identify the alternate in advance. My question is, that wasn't done. I mean, that's clear. Is there a plain error in this case, since there was no objection to it? Also, Ms. Dickinson's comment that this all when the jury was seated, differentiates it from the Moore case. What's your thoughts on that?
Okay. With regard to error, no, there was not error.
Session counsel, if you would also address not only the process by which the alternate was chosen and the fact that it appears to have violated the statute, but the suggestion that is made by the appellant in this case that when that juror was seated, there was no admonition to the jury that they are to begin their deliberations anew.
I don't believe there was an admonition that they begin anew, and I believe our brief cites a case where there was another case just like it, and I believe it was the Carroll case that we cited, where it's a Nevada Supreme Court case, where they talk about, even though in that Carroll case the jury wasn't re-admonished, it was shown during, looking at the time frames as to when, basically this new juror, the replacement juror, had ample opportunity. I think it was four times the amount of time that the previous juror had to deliberate. So in this regard, it's not like he was immediately pressured to go a certain way. There were certainly other 4 hours where they could deliberate, and as a matter of fact, there was a break in deliberations that particular afternoon, and they came back the very next day and began again. And the one last thing that I would like to touch on really briefly is the playback issue. With regard to that issue, I know that the defense is objecting now, they did not back then, but I read through defense counsel's closing arguments, and at least on three separate occasions, defense counsel told the jury repeatedly that there was a readback instruction when this particular courtroom, it's a playback instruction. Three times during his closing arguments, he told the jury, I forget what this person said, there's a readback instruction, don't listen to me in terms of the facts, you know, go back and listen to it, essentially. Again, they're entitled to what's called a readback instruction, which, you know, they'd already been instructed to. And it was calling into question with the crime scene analyst that testified.
Okay, I think we understand that. Just say any more questions for the state. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, Ms. Dickinson, we'll add another minute to you so you can squeeze the additional, so you'll have 5 minutes for your rebuttal.
With regard to the closing, the prosecutor contended that when she commented on reasonable doubt, she was referring to the jury instruction. That's not the way the court saw it, the district court, because they admonished her. She told the jury to look at the instruction. She sustained that objection. So she wasn't just referring to a jury instruction, as she suggests. overall, with regard to her other argument about the tooth extraction, I grant that was overruled. But I don't feel she's explained the other errors that we pointed out, the burden shifting, the comment on his testifying, calling him a liar, and even in some of her comments today, she suggests that he had to explain or he had to prove something about the badge, something about the cigarettes.
I understand that when the defendant elected to testify, doesn't it put some of those comments at issue, you know, where the state can comment about his testimony and not about the obligation, you know, that he doesn't have to testify, but as opposed to a situation where he didn't testify at all and then the state makes a comment like that, is there a distinction between the two?
The distinction is how you comment. Her comments were burden shifting. Her comments were calling him a liar. There's ways to comment on the credibility of the witness without doing that. Moreover, the court had already warned her before and ordered her not to do this. So that's another distinction from...
Ms. Dickinson?
Yes.
Was it the defendant who you alleged the prosecution called a liar, or was it the... victim witness, in this case Mr. Lee, whom it appears the PD referred to as a liar? Or am I just misunderstanding the facts?
What she's contending was that the trial attorney called Mr. Lee a liar in his closing. I'd have to go back through the transcript because I don't recall that. What we're arguing is that her comments were referring that Ruggiero was a liar when he testified.
Well, we're talking, did she use the term liar, or did she comment, which I believe is appropriate, on the credibility of the witness?
She said he was not telling the truth when testifying.
Thank you, Ms. Dickinson. That's very clear.
Yeah, I don't know if that's exact. That's what my notes refer, so it's kind of a summation. I have to go back and get the exact quote, but that was what I had down, what she suggested was not telling the truth. With regard to Mr. Lee and the problems in giving an identification, it goes back to the fact that he's Korean, with problems with the English language. We asked for an interpreter, and that's why some of the issues with regard to identification came up. In their answering brief, the state cites five questions they asked Mr. Lee. His responses were either yes or 100%. You know, there's like almost 90 places where it's unintelligible. There's a problem with this witness. We asked for an interpreter. We didn't get it. We do know that he had a problem with English language because at one point he told the jury that he planted that badge in the Minnesota machine. Maybe he did. I don't know. I wasn't there. So we need an interpreter to clearly understand what he knew, what happened. We didn't have that. With regard to the booking photo, it's part of the appendix. She introduced that to set up a foundation to say that, you know, his identity was, he looked differently. However, that booking photo was taken 2 weeks after this event. So there's no relevancy that that's the way he looked on that day. Moreover, she had the picture on the badge. So I don't think she needed to specifically say, this is your booking photo, and have him identify it. So I find that very prejudicial. With regard to the alternate, the state cites Arizona case law to suggest the judge did not have to bring the jury back in. Arizona statute is much different than ours. Our statute specifically requires the jury to be brought back in the court and admonish when you are replacing an alternate with the remaining jurors. When we objected to the alternate being replaced, the prosecutor admits in an oral argument she initially had no problem with this alternate, did not think he was biased, thought it could be fair, she did not challenge him. However, she thought that other jurors could sit because they had never seen Mr. Lee. There's absolutely no evidence that he was biased in any way.
Okay. Thank you both very much for your excellent arguments and briefs, and the court will take this matter under submission, and the court is in recess.